Chapter 12. 1520 GMT. After the Cobra meeting, the formal contacts were international. As far as Tash could see, a whole hierarchy of meetings was to be set up, beginning with minister-to-minister contacts at Fred Bowles's specialist level, first with closest allies. These would escalate to heads of government, both one-to-one and regionally, and finally a FIS Security Council conference call mediated by the Secretary-General from Geneva. All of it virtual, of course. It was happening fast. Fred's first conference, with the Americans, was called for 3:30 Newcastle time. That was only a few minutes' notice, for Tash, anyhow. But they needed to make fast progress today. Progress that could be demonstrated to the public. And in all of this, a stress by Fred Bowles himself, Tash was to keep open her links to Mel and the Astronomer Royal. Charlie Marlowe was the still one scientific authority Bowles felt he could rely on, and he wasn't about to face the president's science advisor without his comfort blanket live on his phone beside him, it seemed. "Fair enough," Mel commented, from Skythrust 2. "I'm already shielding Charlie from other calls, mostly media and polls. Meanwhile, we are proceeding under lights to the north, hoping to get to Johannesburg, our home port." "No idea what the answer to all this is yet, I take it."
"Tash, we don't even know what the question is yet."
Mel's tiny virtual image, hovering above Tash's phone, shook her head with a rueful smile. Her smile, her best feature, Tash sometimes thought, aside from her strawberry blonde hair. "These bureaucrats sure hit the ground running, don't they? Shame they ain't so quick when it comes to grant renewal time."
"Oh, that's not fair.
Fred Bowles is trying to get his head around a phenomenon that is even more bewildering to him than to you and me. And bureaucracy, okay, but how else do you get stuff done? Some politicians probably are crooks, more are fools. But I suspect most are like Fred, doing their best. Even if he fears he's not up to the job, deep down, and he has to expect his career to end with the sack someday. That's if he doesn't get voted out first. Well, maybe. I think Jane's generation is growing up to be even more cynical than ours, but also more resilient, given the battered old world we have bequeathed them. But they seem to accept it.
Is she okay?
They're keeping her in school, in Yorkshire. Anybody who would have trouble getting home. They say they'll keep her overnight, if necessary. My dad asked after her. Said he could have looked in on her if she was anywhere near Newcastle. She knew Mel had a share in a flat in Newcastle for when she needed to be here with Charlie on government business. Before this crisis, mostly grant applications and other funding issues.
That's kind. She'll be fine.
I think the company would have done Dad some good too. So have you spoken to she recently?
I keep an open channel, Mel said.
Of course, all the spacecraft we have up there are vulnerable. She says they are preparing evacuation protocols, meaning evacuation to some place where they don't rely on solar power. The Moon Gateway astronauts may evacuate to the lunar surface. And there's no change on the Almirich.
Maybe we're lucky we only had one human-carrying craft operating in deep space today.
But one is bad enough, if your fiancé is aboard.
There's no obvious solution there.
You know how those missions are pared down to the bone?
There is very little margin in fuel for unexpected course corrections.
Which reminds me, a heads up for you. There is a longer-term aspect to all this which Charlie Marlowe is already flagging up. You may have heard Jim Boyd himself blurt it out in a broadcast to the world from the Almirich. Look, the loss of the sun's gravity is universal, and it's solar gravity that keeps Earth and the other planets in their orbits, just as it constrains the trajectory of the Almirich. So when the gravity switches off, it's not just a handful of spacecraft that will drift off course. And even if the gravity comes back, there will be long-term effects.
Tash thought that through.
I did hear that, but paid no attention. I suppose I was focusing on the fact that we're all going to freeze to death by Easter. So if the Earth's orbit around the sun becomes distorted, what difference will that make? Nothing good, I'm guessing. Nothing good.
But it all depends on how long this crisis lasts. If the sun comes back, as mysteriously as it went away, I guess. And when? Different seasons, basically. Tash muttered, and if the sun doesn't come back at all? Mel hesitated. Well, all the planets will just drift away. Off into the dark, at their old orbital speeds, heading in whatever direction they happened to be going when the sun went away. But we will freeze long before that makes any difference. A silence. Tash said, One thing I've learned being attached to government is to take one thing at a time, to deal with only what you can control today. Right, so we have to work on the assumption that this isn't an extinction event until it is. I don't think Fred Bowles will put it like that. I'd better go. The captain is monopolizing Charlie again, and she looks like she's going to blow. I'll keep my phone open. Oh, by the way, Uranus went out. 1500. Right on cue. After that, Tash, accompanied by Grace Butterworth, had to dash through house once more to another situation room, F this time. Well, everybody was rushing today. They found the room split virtually in two, with the English contingent facing a smart wall, which displayed a projection of their American opposite numbers. This had been hastily set up. The conference tables pushed up against one smart wall didn't quite match up with their virtual counterparts. Still, the two principals were here. Fred Bowles, UK Science Minister on one side of the virtual partition, and a severe-looking person on the American side. Tash recognised her from news coverage, as well as the vividly colourful shirt she wore, evidently something of a signature. She was Lee Yamanaka, the President's Science Advisor, formerly Assistant to the President for Science and Technology, and Director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. Tash knew little about Yamanaka, save that she was from Hawaii. She made a quick look up on her secure phone. According to the English government data, Lee Yamanaka had begun her career in the high-altitude observatories at Hawaii itself, and later went back home to run them. Another astronomer then. Useful. Lucky to have her in place. But it all depended on how she got on with Marlowe. Tash had seen enough horn-locking among senior scientists before. Among the juniors and officials cluttering up the space behind the principals, including Tash herself, other main players stood out, some projecting in from other locations. Sitting behind Fred Bowles's chair, she picked out a virtual representation of Charlie Marlowe, projected from Skythrust, with, no doubt, a slight signal delay as a result. Then, on the American side, Tash recognised a small, slim woman staring into an old-fashioned-looking phone. Wow! Tash blurted. That's Serena Jones. Jones looked around vaguely. The use of her name had distracted her. She was able to pick out Tash in the noisy virtual environment around her. Was that you, my dear? Tash felt herself blush. Sorry, didn't mean to be fannish. She did know she hero-worshipped this woman. Indeed, he had formerly studied her career for a semester in college. Jones made virtual eye contact now and smiled. Oh, not at all. Here I am, if not in the flesh. In fact, I guess you're all wondering why I invited you here today. A ripple of polite laughter, including the polls. Tash felt herself helplessly charmed. Lee Yamanaka smiled. Thank you for that, Miss Jones. I suspect this will be a grim enough meeting. Breaking the ice is never a bad thing. For the benefit of the record, Ms. Jones is here as an unofficial representative of the New Californian Republic and the AFS, the American Free States, and for her technological expertise. Jones was around 70, Tash thought. Her colour was deep, her short-cut black hair flecked with grey. She looked like somebody's grandmother. Well, maybe she was. Not what you'd expect from the founder of Jones Inc. And Jones had also been a leading figure in the new secession movement in the United States in the early 2040s, after the chaos of the Greenland melt and other disasters, and following her own leading contributions to the mitigation of such disasters. No wonder her charisma was so evident, her political contacts so senior, and no wonder she was here, now, in this crisis. Fred Bowles leaned forward. I think you know why we asked you to contribute, Ms. Jones. You're the entrepreneur who bought space. That's what they call you, isn't it? Amid the stately manoeuvring of egos, Tash knew, he had to remind everybody he was here too, hosting the meeting, if not chairing it, an honour he deferred to Yamaneka. Jones shook her head. Much too immodest. I just waited until the other guys had made all the mistakes and started from there. But as for buying space, talk about Schadenfreude. When the New York Stock Exchange opened a while ago, it fell 20% before they locked it down. I'm getting poorer just sitting here. Yamaneka nodded, grinning. We'll bear that in mind. Thank you, Miss Jones. Grace Butterworth murmured in Tasha's ear. Well, that's the chimp pack hierarchy established. Now we can get on with talking about the end of the world. Yamaneka opened the meeting formally. Thank you all for attending. Usual recording protocols in place. Yamaneka glanced at the human stenographers, a pair of them on either side of the virtual wall. Now let's just get a sense of our significance here, or insignificance. We, in this meeting, are part of a worldwide, multi-level communications network, hastily being assembled. For me, a meeting following on from several others already today, mostly domestic, as for most of you, I guess. Self-deprecating grin. If only we could blow the sun back on with all the hot air, like a birthday candle in reverse, right? Polite laughter led by Fred Bowles. Even dutifully, from the stenographers, Tash noticed. Yamaneka went on. This particular level is minister to minister, advisor to advisor between closely allied governments. Okay. I should emphasize that I myself am only an advisor to my government, with no political allegiance, power, or responsibility. Well, aside from my own quadrennial walk to the ballot box. To remind you, the US and the American Free States have retained for now a common defense infrastructure and command hierarchy. In this emergency, I report to the President of the United States, who right now is in the bunker at Raven Rock, by the way. Quite a trial for President-elect Cox. You'd think this damn thing could have waited for her inauguration at least. Later, our heads of government will talk formally, and possibly press statements will come out of that. Then, there will be contacts across the regions, and with other allies. Ourselves with Canada and the rest of the Americas. You guys in Europe. Similar convocations in Asia, China, Russia, and the rest, the Pacific nations. All of which is designed to feed into a meeting of the FIS Security Council at, I believe, at around 2200 GMT, around 12 hours after the eclipse, the event. She glanced around again, commandingly. I don't need to say that the more open we are, the better these sessions will work. And I should say that there is much alarm in government circles back home. Alarm and confusion. I mean, as far as we can see, we are facing a threat to all humanity. Do I have that right, at least? Nods on either side of the virtual wall. Meanwhile, our space agencies, including Space Command and Space Guard, which checks for asteroid threats, for instance, saw nothing of this situation coming and are at a loss as how to respond. I know that the Secretary of Defense has spoken of raising the DEFCON level, or terrorist threat alert levels. But what is there to shoot at? Marlowe said languidly. I suppose such questions do need asking. Yamaneka glanced at her rival suspiciously, wary, Tash thought, of being mocked. Marlowe had that way with people. Tash wondered if it had helped her further her life goals or not. Yamaneka moved on, glancing down at her own smart table. So let me suggest a rough agenda. We have little time, of course. First item, background. What is the sun? I mean, how does it work? A 30-second briefing, please. Second, what can have happened to it? Has it gone out? Forgive the apparent naivety of such questions. We will be asked these questions, and we need straightforward, non-technical, unambiguous answers. Third, how did this happen? Fourth, if this goes on, The lack of a sun in the sky, well, what then? Fifth, what should we do now? Have I missed anything? Only the point, muttered the Astronomer Royal. She got a glare from Bowles and shrugged. Oh, don't mind me. Very well. How does the sun work? Well, that's simple enough once you know the answer, although it took us until only about a century ago to work it out. The sun is a mass of mostly hydrogen and helium, the primordial stuff of the universe. About 100 times the diameter of Earth, about 300,000 times the mass. These days we have a whole slew of ways to monitor the sun, and we have good reason to. For one thing, we have learned to be wary of solar storms. Earth can be battered by charged particle gusts that knock out satellites, even ground-based networks. So you have the Lodestone station watching the corona, sun watchers at locations like Mauna Kea in Hawaii. Yamanaka grinned graciously enough. My home observatory. There are other observatories in space and on the ground, watching the sun at visible, ultraviolet, X-ray, infrared, radio wavelengths, even gravity waves. The Chinese have a very large solar telescope, recently placed in orbit. And it's only a few years back that the Benson Sun Probe skirted the photosphere, the surface, closely enough to take a direct sample. Today, a lot of these satellites have drifted out of position, by the way, like the Mars spacecraft, the Almirich. Fred Bowles raised a finger. I presume the Chinese will be taking part in the phys sessions later? Yamanaka nodded. We hope so. Marlowe went on. So we understand the sun's dimensions pretty well, or we thought we did. And we know how the sun shines. It is fueled by nuclear fusion. You take 4 protons, hydrogen nuclei, under enormous pressure, and in a complicated chain of events, they ultimately fuse to make 1 helium nucleus. But that nucleus has a little less mass than those 4 protons. And we know that mass is equivalent to energy, thanks to Einstein, and that lost energy is what makes the sun shine. As for your other questions, I can't remember the bloody order. Has the sun gone out? Doubt it. Because, you see, the sun is a pretty big, dense mass, and traps a lot of energy it creates, deep down in its core. That energy is mostly carried off by neutrinos, to which almost everything is transparent and which just zip away. But the sunlight energy that sustains us is carried from the core by gamma-ray photons, which get absorbed by the dense stuff of the sun, and then get re-emitted and reabsorbed over and over. For a single packet of fusion energy, that means it can take a random walk of 1 million years or more before most of it reaches the sun's outer layers, where you have convection, huge fountains of hot gas, helping the heat loss on its way. 1 million years, Fred Bowles said, picking out that number. And so even if the fusion process in the sun's core were somehow shut down, it would still shine for 1 million years or more. To an order of magnitude, yes. So we know you can't just put the sun out. Then what has happened? Now, you could block its heat and light, put some kind of mega engineering shell in the way all around it, made from the stuff of Jupiter, no doubt. Mel whispered in Tasha's ear through her bud. Remember Yale? She always talks about this stuff when he gets going. Yes, Dyson spheres. Marlowe was glaring at her through an unreal wall. Dyson spheres, did you mutter, Miss Brand? Quite right. So, Bowles asked cautiously, could that be what we're dealing with here? Some kind of container? No, Serena Jones said. Nothing so simple, I'm afraid. I say simple. We're talking about erecting a container around a star. I mean, even if we didn't see it being put in place, we would see it now, wouldn't we? A big black mass. What we actually see is a star field where the sun should be. And even if there was a container, the sun's gravity field would not be affected. Correct, Astronomer Royal? Correct, Ms. Jones. Consider our deflected spaceships and habitats. The Almirich, the Lodestone. The sun's gravity no longer pulling on them. They are drifting out of their orbits. And, she said grimly, similarly the planets must be drifting off course, including Earth, as the astronauts have already reminded the world. And that's something we will have to deal with in the future. So I get the immediate point, Bowles said. I think a simple shell around the sun is not enough to explain it all. Even cloaked, we would feel its gravity. Therefore, are you saying that the whole sun could have been destroyed? All its huge mass in an instant? Not at all, Marlowe said, visibly irritated. How could that possibly be so, man? Sorry, Minister. If the whole damn sun had blown up in our faces, it would have taken the Earth with it, after 8 minutes of light-speed delay. And we wouldn't be having this conversation, would we? Bowles kept his cool, and Tash knew he was used to getting what he wanted from temperamental scientists like Marlowe. Very well, Professor. I apologise for my naivety. Then if you're saying the sun was not destroyed, but it has evidently gone, then as you have said to me before, it must have been moved. Tash, even as she absorbed this still incredible suggestion herself, carefully watched the other participants. She saw shock, awe, and sheer disbelief, even if many of them must already have heard this. Serena Jones, though, seemed to be calculating, tapping away at the smart table surface before her. It was all just an engineering problem for her, perhaps. After a few breaths, Bowles took the bait. Moved, then. Moved, Marlowe said. We can be sure. We observed it. And not just with 7 billion pairs of human eyes. We have other evidence. She tapped her phone, and images of ungainly, unlikely spaceborne machinery scrolled in the air of this composite room. A skeletal thing, it seemed to Tash, with long girder-like trusses from which blocky components were hanging. I mentioned gravity waves. These are emitted when large masses move, or collide, or explode, or collapse. And this is the Southampton University Inertial Gravity Wave Detector, the SIG, out in the asteroid belt. Huge thing, as you can see. And this, baby, it turns out, along with other such probes, picked up a tremendous ripple of gravity waves just as the sun was, deleted. Or rather, after the few minutes it took the resulting light-speed-limited gravity waves to travel out to the detectors. It was a sharp peak, a plucking, with spherical symmetry, as if a mass had been ripped out of space-time, deleted. Neat ripples washed out from the sun's location. Clearly the sun has been moved. We have measured the gravitational consequences of that removal. Serena Jones, the technologist, said abruptly, there must be more evidence. For instance, the solar wind should be dispersing slowly. She glanced around the room. That's a wind of charged particles thrown out of the sun, a steady blast. Mag sails, like the one Lodestone uses, rely on that wind. A wind that moves a lot more slowly than light. Taps on Marlowe's phone. Didn't think of that, but I bet somebody did. The wind will have been shut off at source, when the sun was taken away. But there should be a remnant shell still spreading out from the sun's location. Here it is. The termination of that should reach us in a few days. She glanced up. There you are, Minister. A verifiable prediction. Sitting here, we've done some actual science. Thank you, Miss Jones, she said gracefully enough. She looked around the room. So it was moved. We have absolutely no idea how it was moved. And of course, one simpler question. We can't answer yet where it was moved to. Professor Marlowe, said Fred Bowles grimly, let's get back to the point. You just said the sun was taken away. Isn't there an implication here you haven't addressed, with all this talk of evidence? Yamanaka leaned forward and said, you're asking, sir, not so much how this happened, but who did this? There was a silence. Faint shock, Tash thought. Serena smiled. I think we just crashed through a conceptual barrier here. Marlowe sighed. and I was hoping to get away without addressing that. If it isn't even yet some remarkable natural phenomenon. Such as what? Bowles asked, a little helplessly. A monstrous wormhole through which the sun might have fallen? Marlowe nodded. That's conceivable, actually. But such an object would have much more mass energy than the sun itself. We would see it. Her eyes became a little glassy. No, it makes no sense at all. The wormhole would have to have the dimensions of a black hole the size of the sun. The linear size, not the sun's mass. Which would have to have a mass equivalent to about 200,000 suns. The size of a respectable star cluster. That's what you would need, she smiled, ironically. Sitting in the middle of the solar system. We would probably have noticed it, she said dryly. Serena Jones shook her head. If I may speak, I guess I'm biased, given my own background, but even if we can never understand the precise mechanism, I believe this event was technological. As you believe, I suspect, Professor, and intentional. I mean, we know it must be, right? The removal itself was not messy, like a natural phenomenon. Any kind of wormhole would be messy as hell, a rip in space, radiation everywhere. Like the big black hole in the centre of the galaxy, huge flows of gas and dust, throwing stars around like firecrackers. This was clinical, precise, a surgical excision. Do any of you remember Star Trek? Seems to me something just beamed the sun the hell out of here, teleported it. And, a point I see was raised in previous briefs, the removal was clearly timed to coincide with the solar eclipse. The event must have been meant as a signal to intelligent creatures on Earth. A signal, presumably, from some other intelligence. It's actually the only plausible explanation. A brief silence. Bowles said, That sounds impossible. But it also sounds like what happened. And the energy you would need to do all that. To teleport the sun. He looked hesitantly at Marlowe. Marlowe said, We can guess at the power levels required. And that implies a Kardashev Type 3 culture. By which I mean a galaxy-scale culture, Minister. Or at least, a culture able to wield energies on the scale of the galaxy. K3. Tash observed the jargon, noted it in her phone, checked the spelling. Bowles looked irritated now. Kardashev? Didn't he blame Gol for Dynamo Moscow? Grace Butterworth suppressed a laugh with a snort. Marlowe ignored that. I'm speaking of an enormous amount of energy very precisely applied. How? Bowles snapped. For now, I haven't the slightest idea. Perhaps through some exotic physics. A reaching down from a higher dimension of space, which I know some of the physicists argue for, to make sense of their equations. Something beyond our ken, for now. Which doesn't mean we can't analyse its effects. Yamanaka asked, More importantly, why would a K3 do this? Marlowe looked up. We're way out on thin ice here. I really and truly don't want to speculate further. Not without more data. Bowles thought that over. No, I understand. Well, at least you've given us some kind of frame in which to think about this, Ms. Jones, Astronomer Royal. Agreed, said Yamanaka. And I'm getting competing calls. This brief session has been remarkably useful, but I'm afraid we're done here for now. Thank you all. And abruptly she picked up her phone, stood, walked out of her virtual room. Marlowe just winked out of existence, like the sun. So did Serena Jones, with a regretful smile. Tash got her stuff together and stood. She saw that the staff, the stenographers, were packing up too, and found Bowles had already gone. Tash asked Grace, That's it, just like that. Grace raised her eyebrows. Our lords and masters can be efficient when their asses are on fire. Come on. That was the easy part. Now Fred has to brief the PM. She picked up her phone. Oh, by the way. What? Holding up the phone, she smiled, her face transformed. I just got a call from my sister, Ella, in Naples. I'm an aunt. This is turning out to be one hell of a day, isn't it?